From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Yesterday, convicted murderer Roger Keith Coleman was executed in Virginia. To the end, he maintained he was innocent. Today on Fresh Air, we talk with a man who tried to prove Coleman was innocent, James McCluskey of Centurion Ministries. Also, we talk with the New York Times correspondent Philip Sheenan about the protests in Thailand. He's been following the story there since pro-democracy protesters clashed with Thai troops, demanding the ouster of the country's self-appointed prime minister. Later, we meet innovative guitarist and producer Henry Kaiser. He's known for his collaborations with musicians from around the world. And film critic John Powers reviews Alien 3. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Under pressure from Congress, the Agriculture Department today agreed to provide food stamps to residents of the riot zones in Los Angeles. The department reversed an earlier decision and will relax the rules to give victims one-time-only aid to buy food. In Los Angeles today, four men pleaded innocent in the beating of a truck driver early in the riots. Three men are accused of attempted murder and other charges. One man is charged with stealing Reginald Denny's wallet. Bail has been set for all four men, but one of the men will not be released pending a hearing on an unrelated matter. A civil rights group is collecting contributions to pay the bail. A survey says 6 out of every 10 business executives and managers in America is complaining about schools. They say one big reason their businesses are hurting is that schools are not preparing young people for the workplace. The Reuters news agency and the Nightly Business Report sponsored the study. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The poll released today shows that almost all of the 453 senior executives and managers surveyed believe that the quality of the nation's education system is critical to the country's economic future. Yet, only 28% said schools are doing an adequate job. Most business people, especially those running small firms, were downright gloomy about the quality of American schools and the likelihood that they'll improve soon. Almost half of those surveyed said year-round schooling was necessary, and 77% said businesses should become involved in teaching students specific workplace skills. But when asked if they would help pay for training by taxing businesses, 63% said no. The poll showed for the first time that business people are considerably more worried about schools than the public at large, which generally believes that the nation's education system is either good or adequate. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
The Serbian-controlled Yugoslav army says it's halting the withdrawal of its forces from Croatia. Pierre Vickery reports the decision places the entire UN peace deal in jeopardy and could lead to a major escalation of the fighting in Croatia.
Under the terms of the UN peace plan for the eastern sector, the Croatian and Yugoslav armies were supposed to withdraw their tanks and heavy artillery by Monday morning. The Yugoslav army then said hot weather was complicating the withdrawal and requested a two-day extension. Columns of military vehicles then began leaving for Serbia. But the Yugoslav army has now halted the withdrawal, accusing Croatian forces of artillery attacks on its positions. In neighboring Bosnia, a convoy of several thousand women and children held hostage for several days by Serbian gunmen is reported to have been freed in exchange for food deliveries to besieged Yugoslav troops in Sarajevo. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 15 points. This is NPR. A congressional study says poor families are working longer hours than they did a decade ago, but they're earning less. Rich families also are working more, but they're earning more for their efforts. The data was contained in a House Ways and Means Committee report on social spending programs. At least 11 people, including a mother and three children, were killed today in Israeli air raids in southern and eastern Lebanon. The raids were retaliation for a series of recent attacks in the South Lebanon security zone. Linda Gradstein reports.
The situation in South Lebanon is tense after some of the worst fighting this year between Israel and pro-Iranian Hezbollah guerrillas. After months of quiet, Hezbollah stormed a post in South Lebanon belonging to the Israel-backed South Lebanon Army on Tuesday, killing one soldier and capturing four. Today, the captured soldiers were shown on Lebanese TV. Guerrillas also fired Katyusha rockets at Israel, and some landed on the Israel-Lebanon border, although there were no casualties or damages. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Aaron said Israel was responsible for making sure the northern border was safe, and he called on Syria to restrain the Hezbollah guerrillas. Israeli officials said they might put northern settlements on alert if the fighting continues. Voice of the South Radio, run by Israel, also called on South Lebanese residents to flee if there are Hezbollah guerrillas hiding in their villages, a sign that the Israeli air attacks are likely to continue. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Casper Weinberger's attorneys have released a lie detector test that the former defense secretary passed. The tester concluded that Weinberger truthfully said he did not cover up Ronald Reagan's role in the Iran-Contra affair. Weinberger has been a target of the Iran-Contra prosecutor, who believes Weinberger's notes show that Reagan knew more about the 1985 arms sale to Iran than he admitted in front of Congress in 1987. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Last night, after last-minute court appeals had failed, Roger Keith Coleman was executed in the electric chair in Virginia. He'd been found guilty in 1981 for the rape and murder of his sister-in-law. Coleman has maintained his innocence since then and presented his case in the national media. One person who believed in his innocence was Jim McCluskey. McCluskey founded Centurion Ministries, an organization that investigates cases of prisoners convicted to life imprisonment or death who claim that they had been wrongly accused. He took on Coleman's case in 1988, and he was with Coleman sitting for hours outside his jail cell up until the last minutes before the execution. Jim McCluskey joins us by telephone from Richmond, Virginia, which is near the Greensville Correction Center. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Marty. It's good to be with you.
What did you talk with Roger Keith Coleman about last night as you were waiting for his execution?
Well, there was just kind of a wide range of subjects. Kitty Behan, his attorney, and I were we joined Roger. He was in his cell, which is about I don't know, maybe an 8 by 12 foot cell that was located 10 feet from the door that led into the corridor that led into the electric chair room. And we were there from sitting in chairs right across from him outside his cell. We could touch him reaching through the bars. And we were there from 6 to 10 minutes to 11, which was 10 minutes before the scheduled execution time. And we talked about a wide range of things, but I was just struck by his remarkable good humor. I mean, we literally, on several occasions in those hours, we had some genuine, not fake or artificial, laughs. We also, by the way, his last meal that he had requested was pepperoni pizza.
Hmm.
So, along with chocolate marshmallow cookies, and so we shared with him his last meal. They had delivered from the local Pizza Hut, which was probably an hour away because the pizza was so cold by the time it got to him and us. But each of us, we shared his large pepperoni pizza with him a couple hours before the execution. He was very relaxed, extremely composed, in good humor. And then the closer, of course, we got, he maintained that and showed a remarkable degree of just dignity and quiet grace and courage.
How does his execution affect your commitment to your work?
That's what I told him last night when he and I had some private moments together. I was, you know, we were holding hands through the bars, and I was sitting on a chair, and he was sitting on the edge of his bed. And I told him, I said, Roger, I can't tell you how proud I am of you and the way you've conducted yourself, and to be able, it's a privilege to have worked for you, and what is happening to you tonight has just re-fired me, it re-inspired me to continue to work on behalf of the other Roger Colemans of the world, he was he said, well, that's what I was, if you hadn't said that, I was going to say that to you and ask you to please do that.
Do you have any doubts in your mind that he was innocent?
I have no doubt whatsoever that Roger Keith Coleman had absolutely nothing to do with that crime.
What makes you so sure?
Because I spent in the last, rather than reviewing all the details of the evidence, there are some things that you, Marty Mosco, you know, and you might not be able to convince the other person, but you know it's true. And I know this is true because I lived in Grundy, Virginia, off and on over the last 4 years for about 5 months. I've met hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people whose doors I knocked on. And I've met the witnesses down there. I've talked to the people who are scared to come forward because the one person who did come forward was found dead the next day. That rung terror in the hearts of people. And I know Roger, I've spoken to witnesses both against and for Roger. And many people who have come forward to tell me in the privacy of their apartment or trailer that they know who really killed Wanda because that person has confessed to them. So I just know, in the bones, in my bones and in my mind and my heart, that he had nothing to do with it. The Commonwealth, there's no motivation. Absolutely no motivation. He got along great with the victim, his sister-in-law, and his wife, and his wife's family, who asked him to be, the victim's family, who asked him to be a pallbearer. I could go on and on as to why I have no doubts that he's innocent.
So where do you go next? Where you're going to be leaving Virginia pretty soon, I assume. Where do you go?
Richmond tomorrow morning, going back to Princeton. Mm-hmm. And spend all next week just kind of doing admin and a little fundraising work, and then I will be taking at least the first 3 weeks of June off, and I'm going down to some, I forget the name of the island, a friend's house in the, off the coast of Charleston, South Carolina. Spend 3 weeks down there and a week within that with my parents in West Palm Beach.
Is that a way of kind of recovering from this case?
I need to. I'm exhausted, and I'm tired and I'm hurt and hurting, and I just have to get away from everything get my batteries recharged and just think about a lot of things as well.
Jim McCluskey, thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for having me and allow me to talk.
Jim McCluskey was with Roger Keith Coleman last night before he was electrocuted in Virginia. McCluskey founded Centurion Ministries, which is an organization that investigates claims by prisoners facing life sentences or death that they've been wrongly accused. This is Fresh Air. Yesterday evening, the embattled Prime Minister of Thailand, Suchinda Krapayun, and the leader of that country's pro-democracy movement, Chemlong Srumong, met with the King of Thailand, a meeting televised on national TV. Kneeling before the monarch, they reached an agreement to end the clashes that have spilled blood in Bangkok since the beginning of this week. Many of the thousands of jailed protesters have now been freed, and the government said they would push for a constitutional amendment requiring the prime minister to be an elected official, which Suchinda is not. We wanted to find out where things stand now, so earlier today we phoned New York Times correspondent Philip Sheenan, who's based in Bangkok. The king was able to bring calm to the country. I wanted to know what kind of authority he has.
He has a tremendous spiritual authority among Thais of all walks of life. I think many of us who have not been in this region for a particularly long period of time have been startled by how much Thais revere their royal family. This is a reverence that you do not find in places like England, where the royal family comes under intense and rather personal scrutiny. Here the king really is almost a god to his people. There is enormous love for him, and the fact that he would intervene and request calm and peace and some sort of compromise among all the various parties could well put this situation on the road to resolution, though that is not assured at this moment.
Does his spiritual authority then translate into political authority?
It does to some extent, though he is quite careful about using it. In 1932, there was a coup in this country in which the concept of the absolute monarchy was overthrown. The nation retained a royal family, but it's been very touch and go over the course of the last six decades as to how much power, absolute power, or I'm sorry, not absolute power, but how much power the king has in terms of making any sort of real, in terms of making political decisions for Thailand.
Why do you think the king waited until yesterday to bring these two forces together?
Nobody is quite sure why. There have been reports that the king has been working behind the scenes virtually since the day this began. That would have been Monday, to get some sort of resolution. There have also been reports that the military for the first 48 hours prevented the king from taking any part in this, indeed prevented him from addressing the nation via radio and television.
There have been other demonstrations in Thailand in the past. Anything unique about this particular one?
What is startling a lot of the organizers of these demonstrations, if indeed there are real organizers at this point, is that the middle class and the upper class of Thailand are participating. These are, you know, business people, academics, the intelligentsia, people who in many ways never participated before in political matters, certainly hadn't become involved 20 years ago when students, primarily students, rose up to overthrow a military dictatorship. This time it really is all segments of Thai society getting involved, from the poor to the rich, from the young to the old. This is really Thailand's version of people power, what people saw in the Philippines in 1986.
I was reading one of the articles that you wrote in the New York Times, and you quoted a Thai man who said that he could live with government corruption, and he has for many years, but he couldn't abide the lies of Suchinda. Is that the general feeling of the people?
I think people feel and have been living for an awfully long time under military-dominated governments. But there seems to be something very different about their attitude towards General Suchinda, who up until last month was the army commander, arguably the most powerful man in Thailand. There's a feeling that there is for the people of Thailand a loss of face in accepting as prime minister a man who vowed that he would not take this job and then quickly did, a man who vowed he would not accept into his government cabinet ministers who had were corrupt, but then quickly did. There's a feeling that General Suchinda, through his numerous broken promises, has insulted the dignity of the people of Thailand. That, I will say, though, that what these series of demonstrations seem to have proved, however, is that it does indeed go beyond General Suchinda. There's a feeling that after six decades of military rule, a nation like Thailand, which is rapidly developing, it has one of the fastest-growing economies on earth, a well-educated middle class, a well-educated upper class, a strong cultural background, it simply has outgrown the idea of generals making all the decisions in the government. There's a feeling that it's time for something like a true democracy here. People talk about what has happened over the last several years in South Korea, what has happened in the Philippines, and they look an awful lot to the United States as a model for what they would like to be.
Under these 60 years of military rule, what kinds of freedoms have the people of Thailand had?
This is not an authoritarian state as you would find in Vietnam or Burma or until recently Cambodia. There is a real sense of freedom, certainly freedom of thought and of expression to a large degree. The newspapers here are about as lively and unrestrained as any you'll find in the world, and they have been exceedingly tough on General Suchinda. In fact, I think it will certainly be written in Thai history that the newspapers of Thailand, not the broadcast networks, not the television or radio, but the newspapers of Thailand have played a very large role in seeing these demonstrations through, in making it clear to General Suchinda that he does not have public support. But in terms of economic freedom, in terms of the ability of someone to, how would I phrase this, if you want to get into one of the nation's more prestigious colleges or universities, if you want to find a job in a prestigious government ministry, oftentimes if you want to find a job in one of the nationalized companies, you have to know a general, you have to know an admiral, you have to know somebody with pull in the military to get you those things. And that is very offensive to a lot of ties.
Chemlong Srimong, the pro-democracy leader, was arrested this Monday. What kind of democratic change does he represent?
Nobody is quite sure, to be honest. He is a very devout Buddhist who seems to offer a sort of challenge that the governments of Thailand have never before experienced, the leaders of Thailand have never before experienced. He represents an ideology, a pure Buddhist ideology, one in which one does not seek material gain, in which one seeks a certain spiritual harmony that ties a more worldly group than most have rejected over the years. He clearly wants to produce, however, for Thailand a far less corrupt government, a government that would be far more democratic, representative of the will of the people, if you will, if that's not aggrandizing him a bit too much.
How deep does corruption in the country go?
It's enormous. Within the military, you see generals with official salaries that are quite small, living exceedingly comfortable lives, mansions, fancy cars, exorbitant vacations, jewelry. You see an awful lot of Mercedes in the streets, the Mercedes-Benzes in the streets of Bangkok being driven by generals who are being paid $15,000 a year. I don't know quite how you explain that unless there's something fishy going on. There's an awful lot of involvement, we understand, between the generals and the drug trade in Thailand. There's an awful lot of involvement by the generals in industrial development in which generals finish up on corporate boards, finish up as corporate executives when they simply have no background for those jobs, but are able to impose themselves simply because the military controls so much of Thai life.
Have there ever been any kind of government investigations?
Of the generals, no, because the generals simply wouldn't allow it. And I think part of what's going on here, why we have such a violent reaction from the government this week, is that the generals are very fearful that if they lose their control of the government, there will be investigations to find out how they came by their wealth, investigations that would clearly be embarrassing for them. There was an odd irony of all of what is going on for General Suchinda now is that General Suchinda is the man who was the architect of a coup in 1991 that brought down Thailand's last democratically elected government. And at the time, General Suchinda said he acted with his colleagues in the military because the previous civilian government was simply too corrupt. And a lot of people in Thailand agreed with him. The last civilian government in Thailand was enormously corrupt. General Suchinda then announced that an investigation would begin of all of the previous cabinet members of the earlier government. And indeed, those investigations turned up evidence that a lot of the cabinet ministers and their deputies had been taking bribes, had been paid off, however you want to phrase it. General Suchinda then, through manipulations of the Constitution, was able later to become prime minister himself just last month. And to the dismay of Thais who wanted to believe General Suchinda about his intentions in sponsoring the coup last year, General Suchinda accepted into his government many of the same corrupt cabinet ministers that he had overthrown last year.
What's the mood in Bangkok today?
The mood is actually more tension than many of us expected. Last night there was the announcement that the king had brokered an agreement to end the demonstrations on the street and to end the violence. But despite that, despite a belief that people would go back to their business, go back to their homes, thousands of people poured into the streets again today, almost all of them repeating the call for General Suchinda to step down, many saying that what was decided on Wednesday night did not go nearly far enough. And Mr. Chamlong, the opposition leader, the pro-democracy leader, is himself saying that if there is not quick action by the government to live up to the agreement reached Wednesday night, the demonstrations will start all over again.
Do you think it's possible to have a negotiated settlement?
It's possible, but it will take real concessions on the part of General Suchinda, a man who is known for his stubbornness, and who has certainly demonstrated it over the last several days. I don't know what to expect. I think there may be reason for pessimism, at least from the tone I'm seeing of people on the street today.
How deep does that pessimism go?
It's pessimism just for this evening. I've just come back from several hours on the street where people are incensed, not at their king. Their king really is a beloved man, but they are incensed that there is a resolution for the moment that does not end with the departure of General Suchinda. The feeling of absolute hatred on the streets of Bangkok towards General Suchinda is something I can't really get across to you. It's something you have to see for yourself and hear for yourself. But at this moment, unless General Suchinda steps down, I would fear for what will happen next week.
As an American correspondent, can you move freely through Bangkok? Any problems with that?
And you can. You periodically at this point come under gunfire, and there's been an awful lot of lying flat on the ground for the last several days as the soldiers open up their automatic weapons. But yes, there's relative freedom to get around, and the Thais who are participating in this in these demonstrations go out of their way to make sure the foreign correspondents get to see what they need to see. There's a feeling that the foreign correspondents are playing. You develop a certain pride in your role here because the Thais clearly believe the foreign correspondents are playing a significant role in making sure the world understands exactly what is going on here. And that, in turn, brings pressure on the Thai government to compromise.
Have you interviewed soldiers, too?
Yeah, no, we find many soldiers willing to talk to us. I think many soldiers are offended by what they're participating in. We see horrible brutality on the part of some of the soldiers. I mean, people being manhandled like you can't imagine. And you can tell that some of the young soldiers, some of the young officers in particular, aren't behind this, don't support what is happening here. And there have even been reports of mutinies within the armed forces, people who think the General Suchinda is acting in such a brutal fashion that they don't want to be part of it any longer.
How would you compare what the demonstrations look like in Thailand compared to demonstrations in this country? I don't know whether Los Angeles would be one to compare, or some of the demonstrations during the civil rights movement in the 60s here.
I'm afraid I'm not old enough to remember much of the civil rights movement in the 60s, but I think there's a fascinating comparison between what has happened in Bangkok over the last several days and what happened in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago. The Thai protesters have been quite clear that they will not support looting in the city of Bangkok. And indeed, if you tour the city today, you'll find almost no commercial structure that suffered any damage from really oftentimes wild demonstrations in the city. And we, some of us saw protesters marching past commercial structures, marching past houses, and making sure and yelling at their colleagues, these are the people, these are the people. Don't touch private property. Don't touch commercial buildings. If there is to be damage or destruction, make sure that damage or destruction occurs only to the security forces, to the police, and to the army.
So what are you going to do today, and where will you be, and what will you be watching for?
I would tell you that normally we could get a good night's sleep under these circumstances, but it appears, or at least it has certainly been true over the last several days, that most of the big news happens late at night. So my plan for today is in about an hour to head back out again for several more hours to see what's going on.
Well, Philip Sheehan, thank you for joining us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
Philip Sheehan is New York Times Southeast Asia correspondent. We spoke to him earlier today from Thailand. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoane with Fresh Air. Avant-garde guitarist and producer Henry Kaiser calls himself a compulsive listener. Make that a compulsive listener with an ear for the exotic. His influences include music from Korea, Vietnam, India, the Mississippi Delta, and more. Coming up, we meet guitarist Henry Kaiser. And film critic John Powers reviews Alien 3. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate has approved an emergency urban aid bill for the country's inner cities. Supporters say it will also direct money toward rebuilding in Los Angeles. The vote was 61 to 36. Opponents call the legislation a political Titanic. It will provide nearly $1.5 billion more in funding than President Bush wants to spend. The House has passed a similar measure, but with much less money. At a fundraising event today in Cleveland, President Bush stressed stronger family values and personal responsibility as ways out of poverty for the nation's inner cities, adding that government can help. Kevin Niedermeyer of member station WKSU reports.
President Bush told the audience of nearly 600 Ohio Republicans that the time is right for inner city enterprise zones, welfare reform, and programs that increase home ownership. He says these items will ultimately strengthen the deteriorating family unit by putting each individual in charge of his or her own destiny.
Personal responsibility, opportunity, ownership, independence, dignity, empowerment, and that all adds up to the American dream.
President Bush urged Congress to pass Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Jack Kemp's plan for urban renewal. Democratic candidate Bill Clinton was also in Cleveland today talking about family values. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer in Cleveland.
China detonated its biggest underground nuclear explosion ever at about midnight Eastern Standard Time. The U.S. government is expressing concern. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The Royal Observatory in Hong Kong first believed the Chinese test was an earthquake, but Scandinavian seismologists determined that it was a bomb, one of the biggest ever detonated underground by any country. It was estimated at 1 megaton, about 70 times larger than the Hiroshima blast in 1945. U.S. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher confirmed the size of the blast and added,
"We regret that the Chinese have conducted this test and that they are not demonstrating the same restraint as that shown by Russia, ourselves, or the other nuclear weapon states."
Under the Threshold Test Ban Treaty, Boucher said, the U.S. and the Soviet Union limited their underground tests to 150 kilotons. The Chinese blast was at least 6 times larger than that. China has not signed the Test Ban Treaty. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
In Oregon, Representative Les O'Coin is now holding a 39-vote lead over businessman Harry Lonsdale in the Democratic race for the U.S. Senate. The outcome will rest on a count of absentee ballots to be completed tomorrow and on an expected recount. O'Coin and Lonsdale fought a bitter primary battle for a chance to face Republican Senator Bob Packwood this November. Stocks fell today on Wall Street. The Dow lost 15 points to close at 3378.71. This is NPR. Polish President Lech Wałęsa traveled today to Moscow to sign a friendship treaty. Critics at home have questioned the trip. The accord came at the invitation of Russian President Boris Yeltsin. This will set terms for the withdrawal of 30,000 to 40,000 former Soviet soldiers still in Poland. Irish readers of the British newspaper The Guardian were unable to get the paper today because it carried a full-page ad for an abortion clinic. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
Police were waiting at the airport early this morning when the flight carrying 2,000 copies of the paper arrived from England. The offending ad invited women to call the clinics for free consultation. Irish law forbids any advertising for abortion counseling or clinics, and British papers generally don't run such ads in their Irish editions. The Guardian's Irish distributor sent today's copies to a warehouse. This is the latest incident in an increasingly bitter fight over abortion, which is constitutionally banned in Ireland. In February, a 14-year-old rape victim was initially denied the right to travel to Britain to have an abortion, despite the fact that an estimated 4,000 Irish women travel abroad to have the procedure. And abortion will be the crucial issue next month when the country holds a referendum on the European Community's Maastricht Treaty, calling for closer ties with the EC, which guarantees abortion rights. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The Federal Trade Commission is warning would-be dieters to watch out for weight loss programs that claim to be miraculous or guaranteed. FTC investigators have spent the last 2 years looking at diet programs. A spokesman today told the House Small Business Subcommittee on Regulation that the agency hopes to announce industry-wide standards for diet centers. The spokesman said Americans should know that the FTC handles complaints about advertising and marketing. The agency also pointed out that most state attorneys general have the authority to investigate and prosecute unfair or deceptive acts or practices. This is NPR from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Henry Kaiser stays busy. The San Francisco-based guitarist and producer has appeared on over 100 recordings so far. But more impressive than the number of sessions is the adventurous mix of pop, jazz, and avant-garde influences which provide the basis for his music. He's played with musicians and groups as diverse as Richard Thompson, the Rovasax Quartet, and Captain Beefheart. But it's Kaiser's interest in world music which led to his latest project, A World Out of Time. Kaiser discussed the project with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. He and fellow guitarist David Lindley traveled to Madagascar, a remote island off the coast of Africa, to record a number of Malagasy musicians, including Rossi, whom leads the most popular electric band on the island.
Now, the song that we were listening to, you played along with Rossi, who's a Madagascar musician. Can you tell us something about him?
Well, Rossi is the modern electric pop star of the island. He and his 10 or 12-piece band travel all over their island in a truck, and they play a modern roots pop music that's based in all the different traditional musics of the island. And they've been very successful doing this, worked very hard at it.
Who is their audience? Is it young people and old people?
Their audience is all ages, people who want to dance, people who want to hear the social messages of the songs, huge outdoor concerts all over the island.
So they do have social messages? What kinds of things do they sing about?
Well, all kinds of things. There's just kind of love songs and things like that, but then there's songs that encourage people to not be afraid and get vaccinated, or songs about war and politics in Africa and Madagascar, all kinds of things.
And the song that we were listening to, what is that about?
Oh, that's kind of a song that says in a very poetic way, says, let people do things on their own. Don't try to tell them what to do.
How did you end up going to Madagascar to record these musicians?
Well, music from Madagascar has been hard to come by in the United States. In fact, there's really never been a record of roots music from Madagascar released here until now. And for the last 20 years, I've been fascinated by this music, which I've been only able to find on very hard to get European recordings. And I just thought I'd go there for a vacation. And my friend David Lindley, who's a more famous than I am rock guitarist, said, well, gee, I'd like to come too. I said, if you go, maybe we can get somebody to pay us to go to play with people. And he said, no, nobody'd do that. They'd be crazy to. And we talked somebody into it, and it worked out so much better than we thought, because we were supposed to make one CD and we made five.
So when you were looking for musicians to record on the records, what were you looking for? What was your criteria? What type of music did you want?
We wanted Malagasy music. We wanted the roots music that people that's the real music of the people of the island. So we wanted to play those songs. Sometimes we'd play with them and try to add our own voice in support of that. And sometimes we try to make our own little statement in there, but still to keep it Malagasy music. And even when we did cross-cultural collaborations, like a couple of English language songs we recorded or a Japanese song that we did translated into Malagasy, we tried to make it so the end result was really Malagasy in feeling and everything. You can play it for a person from Madagascar and they say, that's our music. The heart is alive.
Why don't we listen to another song where you do that? And this is by Rakutu Fra. And first of all, can you tell us something about him?
Rakutu Fra is amazing, and he's actually sitting next to me right now. Rakutu Fra is a 70-year-old master of Malagasy music. He's celebrating his 60th year as a performing musician this year. And he even appears on the country's currency, which is an incredible paradox because he's a very poor man who lives in a slum there, the third world of the third world. But he's on the country's currency. He plays the sudina, the Malagasy flute. And this piece of music that he's going to play for us occurred spontaneously in the studio when my friend David Lindley was tuning up his guitar. He started to play kind of an American New Orleans-style roots music, chord progression, and Rakutu Fra and his whole band joined in. And I said, hey, wait, stop. And everybody looked at me like, are you crazy? That sounded great. And I said to the engineer, I said, Rami, roll the tape. And then this is what happened.
That's the Rakutu Fra two-step, and playing along with Rakutu Fra is my guest, Henry Kaiser. It says in the liner notes to the record that Rakutu Fra makes his own flutes out of aluminum tent or ski poles. Do they have a lot of ski poles in Madagascar?
I think that's someone gave him one once. You have to watch anything that's thin and tubular when Rakutu Fra is around, or, you know, look away from that microphone stand for a moment and it'll become a couple of flutes. It's anything thin and tubular. And he's found clear plastic tubing over here and colored plastic tubing. He's very excited about that.
Now, does he have to make flutes out of those things? Don't they have flutes over there?
Well, this is a traditional kind of flute, nothing like a Western flute. He makes it himself. And this, you ask a good question. Don't they have flutes over there? They don't have anything over there. The biggest pop star on the island is lucky if he gets a set of guitar strings every 2 years. When you look at the level of income in Madagascar, it makes people say what we imagine to be a slum in Tijuana look like Imelda Marcos's palace in the Philippines. So it's a wholly different world.
My guest is musician Henry Kaiser. He's best known in this country for his free improvisational guitar playing, but his latest project is a series of recordings of the music of Madagascar that he made for Shanaki Records, which he did with musician David Lindley. The first disc is called A World Out of Time, and Kaiser is now touring the U.S. with two of the Madagascar musicians featured on the album, Rossi and Rakutu Fra. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Henry Kaiser is my guest. You play improvisational music a lot, and you've often performed with musicians from different cultures. From doing that, what have you learned that helped you to fit in with these Madagascar musicians in a way that respected their tradition? Is there something you're listening for when you play with them?
Well, improvisation is one of the things that unifies a lot of the music on planet Earth. Most musical cultures, music's based on improvisation. And so David Lindley and I, both being really improvisers, we could be very flexible and deal with whatever was going on at the moment, learn a song quickly, think of something new to say in it. And we're really players, and a lot of the high-profile Western pop stars who've done projects in third-world countries with so-called world music, they haven't really been players, and they haven't really sat down and played with the people, and that's what this project was about.
Tell us something about making the recordings. Did things go much as they do when you record in the United States, or because the culture was different, did it lead to some unusual events?
It was so unusual. It was so spooky, because when you go to a third-world country to do something like this, your wheels are sort of supposed to spin in the mud, and you get one-fifth done what you want to get done in five times as much time. And with us, someone would show us a song, or maybe they even wouldn't show it to us, and we would just play it, and it would be a beautiful, beautiful performance. And I'd look down, and I'd see my hands moving, playing a song I didn't even know. And it was spooky. It was like we were guided by spirits there or something, because we got five times as much done as we intended to get done in one-fifth the time. And a rate of productivity so far beyond the best experiences of either Lindley or I in America. It was weird.
Tell us what the recording industry is like in Madagascar.
Well, it's simple. There's not one. There used to be. They used to put out records there, but the wood-fired record pressing plant broke down.
Wood-fired?
Yeah. Stoke the coal in there. Make more of those hit singles. And it burned down. And then the single record company tried issuing cassettes, but the bootleggers in the marketplace could make those just as quickly and have them out the next day for a cheaper price. So there's no copyright laws there, so no way to make money. It's no recording industry. Big problem for musicians.
So right now they're not recorded at all?
No.
And are these recordings you made, are they going to be available over there?
Well, bootleggers will be selling them in the marketplace, I'm sure. And we've sent, of course, copies of our recordings to all the musicians, so they have their own personal copies, which they can no doubt give to the bootleggers. And we've, of course, sent recordings to all the radio stations there so that they have them. One of the shocking things we found was that of all the people there who'd made recordings for foreign record labels, mostly French ones, they'd never been given a copy of their recordings, ever. Most of them have never, ever been paid.
Huh. I want to play a song by Gari, and he plays acoustic guitar, and he has a very unusual sound. Can you tell us what's different about his guitar playing?
Whoa. Well, Gari was one of the big shocks of our visit. Dama Mahaleo, who's kind of the John Lennon, Bob Dylan, and Muddy Waters of Madagascar rolled into one, said, "You've got to meet this guy. You've got to hear him. He's from a very small town, and no one knows about him. He's an incredible guitar player who's taken the different musics of all the traditional instruments, like the valija harp and the kabusi weird little guitar, and he's transferred them to guitar and made up his own style, and he's a virtuoso." And even with this advance promotion for Mahaleo, we were totally unprepared for what Gari was, for he's one of the finest guitar players on the planet, totally original, totally unusual, amazing.
Can you tell us more about his style of guitar playing that's different from how you play?
Well, he's a virtuoso acoustic guitar finger picker, and I mean a spectacular virtuoso. David Lindley and I, who both, we know our way around the instrument, we could sit right in front of him and look at what he was doing, and we couldn't begin to understand what was going on. It's the way he moves his fingers. What's he doing? You can't tell. You really can't tell. It's just something totally new and totally different. No one's seen it before, and you have to look at it for a while before you can understand it. And, you know, good luck just listening to a recording.
Well, let's listen to Gari's guitar playing. What is this called?
This is called Vavaranu, which is the name of his hometown region, a place that's, I think, at least 3 days' hike off the main dirt road. It's isolated. Thank you.
That's Gari off the new record, A World Out of Time, recorded by Henry Kaiser and David Lindley. You're on tour now in the U.S. with Rossi and Rakutu Fra. They've probably never been to the United States before.
They never have, and they've never played together before as a duo and as an ensemble with us. And it's a fun experience because Rakutu Fra is a 70-year-old man from a rough kind of a country music tradition, and Rossi's the sophisticated young pop star with the smooth voice. Rakutu Fra's got a rough old voice, and it's interesting. It's lots of fun. They sound great together.
Is American culture a shock to them at all?
Well, the Malagasy people are very wise. They're very educated. They're very adaptable. And they take everything in stride. Occasionally we have our little trick on Rakutu Fra. We took him to Disneyland, and we took him on the Star Tour space ride, and we told him he was really going into space, and he believed us. And the other prank was his favorite thing there. He went on this one ride, and before he went on it, I told him it was the Christians' idea of hell. And it's a small world with all the little dolls singing the repetitive song, and he liked that. That was his favorite, the hell ride.
Have they been going out to hear music while they're here?
No, we haven't. We're on such a busy schedule that we haven't got a chance to hear much of anything. I hope we do. We've had a lot of parties with a lot of musicians. We've gone over to Jerry Garcia's house and jammed with him, gone over to visit Linda Ronstadt, and visited a lot of friends of mine like that, and had a lot of parties with traditional American musicians playing, trying to mix the American music with the Malagasy music. Even some Vietnamese musicians, we had a party with them. We have fun. Contact with people directly. That's what we're doing.
Henry Kaiser, I really want to thank you for coming by and talking with us today.
Thank you.
Henry Kaiser spoke with Fresh Air's Amy Salad. Henry Kaiser and David Lindley will be appearing with Rossi and Rakutu Fra on Friday night at the Washington Square Church in New York for the last concert of their tour. A World Out of Time is on the Shanaki label. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Hi, Robert. What are you covering on the show?
Hello, Marty. We'll be hearing about why the King of Thailand is able to bring peace so effectively to his country. We'll also be hearing about the problem of sex abuse within the Catholic Church. An agreement on the GATT, General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. So there seems to be a solution to that negotiation involving so many nations in the world over terms of trade. And we'll be hearing about the tiny sliver of Azerbaijan called Nakhichevan, which right now has brought about some very strange saber-rattling by not only Azerbaijan and Armenia, but Iran, Turkey, and Russia, too.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Running facility has suddenly developed a few problems. I can only hope we are able to all pull together over the next few days until the rescue team arrive for Lieutenant Ripley.
It's here. He got coming.
Stop this raving at once.
I'm telling you. It's here.
Yes, it's here. Alien 3. Guest critic John Powers has this review.
Have you ever stayed in a lousy relationship because you kept hoping things would return to the way they used to be? That's how it feels watching Alien 3. If the original Alien played on your nerves like water torture, and its sequel Aliens took you on a roller coaster ride, this third installment of the series is like slogging through a swamp. Sigourney Weaver is back as Ripley, the gritty warrant officer who attracts bloodthirsty aliens the way a carrot does rabbits. Ripley's spaceship crashes on an isolated prison planet whose all-male inmates practice a whacked-out brand of fundamentalism. This is not a happy planet. And within minutes, the authorities have chopped off all of Ripley's hair. Although she looks gorgeous in this new do, sort of like an escapee from the Beverly Hills gulag, it does nothing for her credibility. Even when inmates start getting slaughtered, the warden refuses to believe her story about the alien.
It's an 8-foot creature of some kind with acid for blood, and it arrived on your spaceship. It kills on sight and is generally unpleasant. And of course, you expect me to accept all this on your word.
No, I don't expect anything.
Tell me, Lieutenant, what would you suggest we do?
Well, what kind of weapons have you got?
This is a prison. It's not Not a good idea to allow prisoners access to firearms.
Keeps them from killing you.
Fear? There's no way to escape. With the arrival of the next supply ship, the company would eliminate.
This is a maximum security prison. And you have no weapons of any kind?
It's at this very moment that the movie goes permanently wrong. In its opening scenes, Alien 3 seems to be grappling with weighty issues of redemption, apocalypse, the links between good and evil. It's like an episode of Star Trek directed by Oliver Stone. But someone, perhaps the executives at 20th Century Fox, clearly got nervous that such metaphysically moody chat would bore the audience. And so the last hour drops any pretense to big themes and becomes simply a movie about weapons. Skulls get crunched, bodies get shredded by enormous fan blades. The walls are spattered with so much flesh and blood, they look like a Jackson Pollock retrospective. Now, there's nothing wrong with horror films being filled with violence. It's the essence of such movies to plunge us into death and destruction. It's part of their cathartic value, part of their kick. Yet good horror movies have rich psychic meanings beneath the surface of the action. In the original Alien, the murderous creature growing inside actor John Hurt's body wasn't simply a mutating monster, it was a visceral metaphor for both cancer and the unconscious. And similarly, in Aliens, the proliferation of goopy monsters who killed people one by one had a special resonance in a society just taking the full measure of the AIDS plague. Although the alien in this new picture does bear an unnerving resemblance to Marilyn Quayle, this is probably not intended as political allegory. In fact, despite all the opening hour's highfalutin religious flummery, there's nothing going on beneath the surface of Alien 3. Nothing, that is, but Hollywood's usual desire to cash in on a popular series. At one point, the beleaguered Ripley suggests that the real villain isn't the spiky-toothed alien, but the big corporation back home that's willing to let her and the others die in outer space. I kept wondering if she was referring to 20th Century Fox.
John Powers reviews film for LA Weekly and New York Magazine. Fresh Air's engineers this week are Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, and Audrey Vablaitis. Terry Gross returns tomorrow. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You might not know that's Ry Cooder playing mandolin with the Rolling Stones on this recording of Love in Vain. He's appeared on dozens of other recordings. His latest project is Little Village. On the next Fresh Air, we meet Ry Cooder. I hope you'll join us.